Dig a little deeper from Amir Boynton Robinson. It is easy to think shallow as we watch the TV tube, deeply drinking of its nonsense, though all principles exclude. It takes no brain but sponge instead, absorbing what you wish, to fit your every fancy, though shallow as a dish. Have you thought of digging deeper in a mind that's yours to keep forever and forever, where there'll be no cause to weep? Wisdom is a precious stone, is found by digging down into the precious mental cup where jewels can be found. It takes a lot of thinking in the quiet of the night, where angels gently whisper, "I'll help you get it right. Just follow my instructions. Don't be afraid to think. God endowed you with wisdom. From work you must not shrink. Just dig a little deeper in the vessel of your mind. There's love for everybody and compassion you will find. There are also peace and justice, confidence and self-esteem, grand jewels of all description, good health you can redeem. So dig a little deeper in the vessel of your mind. Be sure to do researching. There are diamonds you will find."
Ladies and gentlemen, this is quite a pleasure for me to stand before you. As a rule, I have been entertained and I have entertained our teenagers and younger people. And as I came in, I said, I wonder what is the best thing to say to the adults that are the age of my children. And I'm very happy to be here. I hope you listened at the music and the poem with an open heart. When you think of that song, sinners, please don't let this harvest pass. And when you think of what we are going through now, it is something that we have never gone through before. The whole world is on a pinnacle. And as a rule, we are satisfied because nothing is disturbing our way of life. But when we look around and realize that we can't be selfish, we cannot be to the place that we think because we are getting along all right, everything else is all right. All we have to do is to begin to think whether anything is going to concern us. There were people in New Orleans who thought that they were all right and that the water wouldn't hit them when Katrina became a reality. But we found that it had no respect of person. What is happening now, that is what you have read about, that is happening first in the United States of America and now the world. We can't sit and say it's not going to touch us, because what happens to one people will happen to all. The world is much closer, so to speak. It used to be a time it took you weeks and perhaps months to get from the United States to let's say, to Russia. And now you do well if you get there in 13 hours. So when you think of the number of places we have to, and transportation that we have, we realize that it can even be better. And it will affect all of us. But before I go into what's happening, I do want to bring you greetings from the other part of the United States of America, the part that I represent, the part that believes in the Constitution of the United States of America, which is all men are created equal, and that every man is endowed with liberty, and every man has the opportunity to work and get. So it is not the part that it says that we believe we want to make war on somebody. And that's the part that concerns all of us, whether we want it to concern us or not. And we wonder, why is it that I didn't touch it.
Good. I think it'll work.
Why is it that we should be concerned in it? And rightfully so. I have wondered too. Why is it that these other countries bow to the United States of America, either by sending their troops or by letting them have land that they may be able to establish a jumping-off place to destroy people? And I wondered even to this day, why? But when I pick up something that almost anything I see made in the United States of America, made in Russia, or made in Japan, or made in China. And that's the reason why. This is like a web. And I remember when I was small, and I didn't see how it could be figured out. And my mother used to say, "Oh, what a woeful web we weave when first we practice to deceive." And when it comes down to this war that we are in, that is eventually going to destroy the entire world unless other countries stand up and say, enough is enough. You will not go into other countries, or we will take side with those who are fighting against you. We've got to stop it. We are on a pinnacle. And I'm quite sure all of us know that from time to time, there has been an artifact, or maybe a skeleton, or something that they say, this is unearthed. This is a human being skeleton of 2, 3, or 5 million years ago. And why is it do we think we can sit on the outside or help to destroy? And you know, there are different ways that a country is destroyed. When you think of the countries, we are not built on love. We are built on money, or something that is used for money. And you might know that we have been putting money in different departments, such as the stock market. Those who are responsible for holding the banks, the hedge fund, and all of them are in trouble. Because of what happened in England, don't think it won't touch us. Because what has happened in other places where banks have been sold to bigger banks, We needn't think that it hasn't happened to us. Because if we don't do something, it will be just like the Negro spirituals. I ran to the rocks to hide my face, and the rocks cried out, "No hiding place. There's no hiding place down here." And when I think of how man is so greedy that he doesn't care whether it hurts anybody else, all he wants to do is to be able to say, "I did that," or "I'm responsible for that," or "What difference does it make?" And I'm thinking about something that happened in Selma, Alabama, where I spent around 55 years during the time that we were fighting to get the right to vote, not for any, for one person, and not for myself, because I was a registered voter when I became of age, but for all of those that were on the outside of safety, all of those people throughout the whole country who had to accept whatever was imposed upon them by the sheriff, by the police department, by the state troopers, without being able to go through the regular channels, the judges, the courts, and ask that justice be declared. There's a typical example of Dr. King coming into Selma. And he came, as he did throughout the world, with love, with understanding, with nonviolence, with being the brother of all mankind. And he decided, we had only one hotel in this small town. It was the most beautiful hotel, of course it was white, and it was built by the Greeks in the form of the Greek letter, and everything in that hotel was made, came from Greece. And when people came on, as tourists, that's the first thing they saw, and many of them came specifically to see this beautiful hotel. Dr. King came in and went to the hotel to register. And the registrar looked at him and said, "We don't have any colored people in this hotel." He walked on out. In 3 weeks' time, that hotel was torn down from top to bottom, and the land was leveled off. Now, you sometimes wonder, how stupid can we get? I used to hear when I was small to cut your nose off to spite your face. And to me, that was a typical example of cutting off their noses. And it was approved by the city that we will tear it down because we don't want one person of color to come into that hotel and sleep one night. Now, those who stood on the outside might not have liked it, but they were afraid. They said that they were afraid. I've had some people to tell me that Jim Clark, I know what he did. I know how he beat people up, put them in jail, but because of the fact that he was, a man that's supposed to have the power, then we will let him go on, and we don't agree with it, but we're not going to say anything. And that is just as bad, not saying anything, not crying out against injustices, is as bad as taking a part in it. And unless we cry out, we find ourselves being afraid. And you know, fear is a terrible thing. I think so often of two people. Both of them lived in the same community. Both of them went to preschool together. And both of them went to school together. Both of them became teachers. One teacher said that, you know, I want to advance myself. And the other said, well, I'll tell you, I got this job and I'm satisfied. I'm getting a salary. And the first teacher, and we'll call her A and the other one B, said, I'm going to take another test and see can I raise the standard in order that I might be promoted to a higher class. And the other said, oh, I'm satisfied. I'm not going to be bothered. So that teacher continued to take tests to rise, and she finally became the superintendent of the school, of the school. And the other teacher became jealous. First, she was afraid to move up. Secondly, that fear became jealousy. And though she felt that way about it, jealousy did not stop right there. Because teacher number A said to her, come on, I'll help you. Oh no, she was such a coward that she didn't even try to advance. Then this teacher number one said, well, listen, I'm going to fight until I get a different program in this school. Well, I hope you won't bother mine because we're getting along all right. And yet, she got to the place that all of that love that she had for teacher number one became not only fear, that fear grew into jealousy. And the jealousy became so terrible that it became hate. I hate her because she thinks she's somebody. Have you ever heard those words before? She thinks she's somebody. I hate her. For no reason whatsoever. And this is what happened in Selma, Alabama. This is what happens throughout the world. That hate that we have, it doesn't hurt the hated, the hater, but it hurts the hated. When we think that we are getting away and because we don't like what is going on and we are satisfied, we get to the place we are like I guess most of you, sometime or other, have seen a beaver. The beaver, and you know, when God made animals and people, he certainly gave them something to protect them. The beaver is a rodent, and it can dam up a creek or a small canal or a ditch. It pulls down little limbs, leaves. It gathers sand, it gathers little rocks, and will so dam up that body of water that the water cannot flow. And that's the way it is with hate. When we first begin with fear, and then jealousy, and it turns into hate, and that hate is something that will destroy the hater and not the hated. I spoke to a group of folk yesterday, and one of the young men, in asking questions, said, Have you ever hated? Because I said I love everybody, which I do. And I had to tell him, yes, I hated. And I told him the story about my hating that actually cured me forever and ever and ever. And it was like this. Selma, the state of Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, as far as Texas, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, all of those southern states had governors that would get together and whatever one would do, the other would do. And if one black person were killed, there was no way that his parents would be able to take that suit on to the United States Supreme Court, because it will stop right there. There was no justice in court. There was no justice anywhere. So in this case, I went to the courthouse. In fact, one of the cases was where the plantation owner, he had all of these African Americans working for him. And the plantation owner came to the plantation one Saturday morning and said, I want you all to get out there and pick that cotton. And the two boys, 18 and 20, said, this is the day for us to go to town, and we are not going out there. Oh, yes, you are going out there and pick that cotton. I don't care what day it is. And they said, well, Mr. Jones, we're not going out. Well, I'm coming back here. And when I come back here, that cotton better be picked. So the truck left. And the kids with his mother and a smaller brother said that if they come back, we're going to have to protect you. I don't know what they're going to do. Then the truck came back late that evening with two or three other men. These two boys picked up a shotgun or BB gun and went to the woods. And when they went to the woods, they heard their mother and their baby brother crying, screaming and hollering, and they even heard the licks. So they came back toward the house and they shot in the house and peppered one of the fellas' faces. Okay. They were arrested and put in jail. Then there was another case of a white policeman who had on his police hat, his police uniform, the police gun, and went to an African American's house, elderly people, and asked for this lady's granddaughter whom he was going with. And she said, I don't know where she is. Oh, yes, you do. You get her. And he came back the second time and she again said, I don't know where Sarah is. And the third time he came, he got an African American to go to the house and to rap on the door. Then as soon as he opened the door, after he identified himself, this guy, police, rushed in. And the fellow who opened the door got back in his taxi and went on about his business, not actually knowing what was going to happen. And he started beating this 70-year-old woman because he said, you know where Sarah is. You just don't want me to see her. And she screamed and said, I don't know. And after he beat her, he threw her over the banister of the small porch and shot her twice. Now, they called the police and he was arrested. But within 15 minutes, he was out going on about his business. And when that happened, the two cases were tried in the same court. The first case of the two boys who were protecting their family were given 15 years for each count, 15 years for having a gun, 15 years for having discharged it. That means 30 years in prison. And I thought that was so unfair. But I sat there to wait for the next case. Then the case of this police came up. And his lawyer said this, "Gentlemen, if you were to punish this fine, upstanding white gentleman, no Negro, no white man can go to a Negro's house. So stop it right here and let him go free." Then the jury came in and said, "We find Officer so-and-so not guilty." And here I sat and heard both of these cases. I was so filled with rage and anger that became hate that I went back home, fell across the bed, and screamed to the top of my voice. I cried for about 2 or 3 hours. And it was nothing I could do, but I just cried because of the injustice. And I said, this is just the tip end of what happened every day throughout the South. And that time my husband, who was a very understanding, calm, and a man who was very diplomatic, when he came in, and the minute I saw him, I said, "You know what happened? I just hate them. I hate. And he gently took me by the hand, took me to the mirror. And when I saw myself, I was surprised. I had cried until my eyes and nose and mouth and everything was like one piece of beef. I didn't know which was which. Hate had overcome me. And he looked at me and he said, "Now look in the mirror at yourself. Who are you hating? Those people out there don't know anything about it. But look what you are doing to yourself." Then I made a right about turn. I love myself. And I cannot hate those people and love myself. So I said that because that's what hate will do. Even though I know what's going on, and you know, discrimination is not dead in the South yet. I don't know whether you heard of what happened in Louisiana or not, but we still have to fight. But we know just why Dr. King came. He came to teach us love, nonviolent love. And of course, when we do that, we can overcome anything. But then, we can't overcome anything unless we have faith that it can be done. But faith without work is no good. First, we have to believe and have this faith. And if we have faith, the Bible says you can remove mountains. It doesn't mean the physical mountains. It means the mountains of trouble that we have. And I think all of us have struggled, and we have had mountains. And they can be moved, but they can only be moved when we have the strength and have the faith and believe that God can remove them. And this is one thing, the reason why I am working today, particularly mostly with young people, to give them the strength to carry on. To not believe what somebody else says, but to find out for yourself. I remember when I was working all of those years before Dr. King came in. I wasn't working by myself. I, My husband and I were a team, and we were working together. And though we were pressured because we were taking people off of the plantations, the very best people they had, who wanted to see their children come up independently, who wanted to see their children go to school. At that time, what I worked, the things that I worked under, these kids were going to school 3 months, that's all, 3 months, with a pot-bellied stove that smoked, and if it were cold or if it rained, they'd have to close those shuttered windows, and the kids would be sniffing and trying their best to see the book. If those boys, 12 years of age or over, needed to be on the plantation to clean up or whatever it is for the next year, they were taken out of school, and they were told, you're going to have to clean this ground up. And we realized that all of the scientific ways that we were taught, I was taught to help the people in the rural district. My husband was teaching them how to raise better crops. We tried to get those people off of the farm. Many of them decided that, yes, I want a better life for my children, so I am going to believe, I'm going to follow you. And there was one white guy who lived in Selma, Alabama, and he said, if you have any people on your farms, and we worked with all of the farms throughout the county, have them to come up here, and I will loan them money to buy land without charging them interest the first year. And many of them did, though. But the plantation owners looked at us as being an enemy to them and told us, you are disturbing our way of life. We have had these Negroes where we want them. We use them when we get ready, just like we want to use them. And here you are taking them off of our farm. We are not going to take it because you are disturbing our way of life. And when they told us that, we just said, well, they are not animals, they are human beings. They need to become independent. Oh, they became enraged. Because we worked for the federal government, they were afraid to kill us, but they told us that we are going to kill you. The telephone became a nuisance. Beginning at 7 o'clock in the evening until 7 o'clock the next morning, the phone would ring every 5 minutes. Get out of town. You better not be seen on the street. You're going to be killed. And all of that we had to endure. My son, who finished law, came home to take his test, and while he was studying, they shot, and right across his head, the bullet went. They ran my husband off of the highway. The car was a total loss, but he was not hurt. A man came into his office to beat him up, and I happened to be there, and of course I stood between them. And that man, in 5 minutes' time, he was walking down the street. But my husband went to the hospital for the last time, and the last words he said to me was, see that every person is a registered voter. And I felt as though there was a charge I had. But do you know one thing? Fear is a terrible thing. The whites did not like what was going on, but they were afraid to go against the sheriff's way of life, the masses of whites' way of life. And that is, you might not believe it, but you know what the salary was? $2 a week. That was top salary. $2 a week, working from the morning until late in the evening in the houses or wherever they were. And that was what the guy was, guys in fact, it was more than one, what they were talking about when they said, my way of life, our way of life, we don't want it disturbed. Dr. King could not come into Selma, but he sent a guy in, and he worked with the young people. And working with these young people who had nothing to lose, they were students, and they had no job that they could take. But when they went to the white, to the black school, they were run off of the campus. They went to the white, to the black college, and they were run off of the campus. And the students just followed them, followed this leader that Dr. King sent in. And when my husband passed, and one of the ministers was asked to let him have a church, this is the guy that Dr. King sent in, the minister said, all right. The deacon said, no, you don't. So brainwashed till they thought they were thinking like the way of life was, and they didn't want to break it. In the meantime, the sheriff, who was very, very evil, said, all full-blooded white men come to my office, be sworn in, and be given ammunition. And they left their turpentine stills, their whiskey stills, whatever they had, and they went there and they were given a club. The night, the Friday night that this memorial for my husband was to be had, those who came, around 400 of them, the way they came on and had to come through a line of deputized sheriffs. And the sheriffs, some of them went into the church. And of course, they got the message, whatever it was. And on Monday morning, when they went to their jobs, they were told, you got no job. You go back home. You are fired. And the first question they ask is, didn't I do my job when I left here Friday? Why is it I'm fired? Because you attended that memorial for that S.W. Boynton. And it was then, for the first time, the fear that these people had turned. And they said to themselves, well, I didn't know I was a slave. My children are out there marching and demonstrating and going to jail. I'm going to get in that line, and I'm going to march, and I'm going to demonstrate too. And they had faith that this will happen. And let me tell you some things that faith can conquer. If we have faith and no works, we can't get anywhere. But those people decided they were going to march, they were going to demonstrate, they were going to jail, they were going against the things that they lived with those many years. But what faith will do, faith will give us the determination. But with that faith, we will have to give. We'll have to give a part of it to somebody else. We have to care for people. We have to realize that we are our brother's keeper. We've got to believe that we can conquer whatever it might be. We have to have tolerance, kindness. We have to see what we can do for somebody else. And that's where we will actually be happy. After all of this happened, and I was beaten and left for dead, as they told you, as I did some of everything. The house was shot into, had to be fixed, and all of this. I decided, with all of the fight that I had done, we've got the right to vote now, and we've got the Civil Rights Bill, and what am I going to do? And it happened that I went to New York, and a guy was talking to us. I had married again, and this fellow was talking to me instead of talking to my husband, who was 6 feet tall. And finally he said, we've got a blueprint where we're going to put water across the Sahara Desert. And with my realizing that there are parts of California that was once a desert, and if you go there today, you'll find out that it's the most beautiful place. I knew it could happen. And then I started listening to him, and he started talking about driving drugs out of some section of New York City. And I listened. Then he invited me to come to a meeting. In the meantime, I asked him a question of who's heading? What's the name of the organization? He said the name is ICLC, International Labor Committee Conference. And I said, I've never heard of it before. And I began to ask people, and they had not heard. So then I decided, well, the only thing to do is to find out for myself. Not because this guy told me, but I'm going to find out to see what type of organization this is. Then I went to Virginia, and there I found this man. And he didn't have a scroll, but as he talked, I could see for 35 years what I had done in the scroll. I saw what Dr. King had done. I saw what Mahatma Gandhi had done, and I said, well, this is the place where I belong. And finally, I was asked to come back to some of the other meetings. And today, just going to the meetings was not enough. I said, I would like to give myself, because this man, when people start talking about somebody, you better find out who it is. They talked about Christ. They talked about the disciples. They talked about Martin Luther King. And they talk about Lyndon H. LaRouche. And he is the man that has the blueprint to save not only the United States of America, but the entire world, because just like countries, maybe not your country, but countries are going along to get along with the United States with all of its evil to destroy people just because we want to get along with them. That's not enough. We can't help that way. We only help when we stand up for what is right, and if we do that, we will find others that will realize that you are right. And wherever there is unity, you will find there is strength. And we needn't feel that anybody is inferior. Nobody is inferior. When God made man, he didn't make a whole lot of men. He stooped down and took the very humble part of what he had made, and that was the dirt, the clay, or whatever the ground was at that time. And then he made one man, and he needed something that he could communicate with. And he could have communicated with the elephant or the tiger, but I don't know how you feel about it, but as a child, when we say, that God made man in our own image, we start thinking about the head, the feet, the color, and whatnot. But after he had made man, he blew the breath of life in man, and man became a living soul. That is the part that belongs to God. And he doesn't need clothing. He doesn't need a house to live in. He only tells us to love me. Because when you love, you get. He said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all of thy heart, thy strength, and thy might, and thy neighbor as thyself. Now, when we get out there like George Bush and destroy people, there is no love. Everybody is our neighbor, regardless of whether they live east, west, north, or south. So we are our brother's keeper. And it's just like what happened with me when I hated as I did. I would have to give an account to God for hating. Thank God that he can redeem us. And that is the same thing. We have a job to do. And the job is to help to straighten up this world that every man, woman, and child will be able to have a decent place to live. We may not realize or we may not feel the pressure now, but we don't know what's going to happen. The missiles, the atomic bombs are in the hands of so many people, and we don't know who's going to be the first one to push the button. And nobody knows, we may be history. And that can be stopped. He is this one man, and God does not work with a whole lot of people at one time and say, follow all of these people. One man has the blueprint that we can save this country, that we can save these people whose homes are mortgaged and they're about to lose it, millions of people. We can make jobs. And I think you saw a few minutes ago with reference to infrastructure, how there can be a system of transportation that will link up with the whole world. And we have the mind. We have the understanding. We know what to do. And it's nothing we have to ask for. We've got it mentally. And all we have to do is to straighten up this country that we may be able to go forward. We cannot go forward in any length of time or space when we are fighting an ungodly war, killing people for no reason. Thousands and thousands of babies have died. And why? Because like destroying the Greek building, there are people who just want to see it done. But we have to stop. And with love and understanding, with realizing that we are our brother's keepers, and it is up to us to not make discrimination because of the fact he's too short, or he's too fat, or he's not my color. It doesn't help. We are all God's children, or whoever we serve. And we want to thank our being, our Heavenly Father, for giving us the opportunity to live and to be able to help even the little ones who maybe they don't know the difference between love and hate. So let us love. Let us stop and think for ourselves. And wherever there's a group anywhere that is doing something for humanity, let us join in and help them. Because we are on this earth not to fill space, but in order that we might grow mentally and give to the world the very best that is in us, and the best will come back to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Amelia. So we will have time for some questions. I think Amelia will take them seated, but I think even this microphone can be moved. So whoever has a question for Amelia should use the opportunity. When did you meet Linda and LaRouche the first time, and how did your cooperation work out?
The first time I met Linda and LaRouche was at one of their conferences in 1980, when they had a conference in Leesburg, Virginia. That was the first time that I had seen him, and I realized then that he knew about Dr. King. He knew about Mahatma Gandhi, and those people were my idea. And I felt like to follow the program that he had, that I couldn't go wrong. Because he wasn't talking about people who were able to take care of themselves. He was talking about these countries and people who had nothing and who were being oppressed by bigger countries.
My question is, if you have fear to stand up for something political, to be important, what is then your best proposal for one to have the faith, get the faith?
Number one, if you have the faith, you investigate. You find out whether it's the best thing, and then you can within you find out whether there's something that you can add to that, because there's something good in everybody that can make the best better. So just investigate, number one. You believe it's right, but you're not going to take, because if it's good, you're not going to find everybody who is following. Let's take, for instance, Christ. How many people follow Christ? How many people follow the followers of Christ? Just few people. Very few people. So, what we say is be sure that you investigate, and then when you find this person with the faith that you have, in this institution or organization. Work with them and make contributions, whatever it might be. You may have suggestions of where to go. Somebody over here, or some community, or some school, or whatever it is. We'd like for you to go over there and talk with them. Because in all of the places, we have people who are being led wrongly. And this is where we all come in. But just have the faith. And don't forget God.
What's your suggestion about how you motivate people out of their routine? Like your story, the parents didn't act like the students until they were knocked out of their routine by losing their job. But how do you suggest humanity loses its attachment to routine?
People don't act until they lose their routine. Like the young people, their parents didn't do anything at first until they lost their jobs. So now today there's a lot of people, but the youth don't do anything because they have their normal life, their routine. So how do you go about it?
Sometimes you can turn your own adult around. But as the young lady, the question she asked, first, believe that you can turn your own parents around. And you can do it when they see that you are doing something that perhaps can help them. And then talk with them. Get them to understand that's what's happening now. Let them know, as I said, that this world can be destroyed. And we had better try to fight. And fight non-violently, not with guns and things. And in the event that you live in a country where we have worked or we are helping to destroy people in Iraq or wherever it might be, then as a people, we need to go after our political folk who are responsible for sending our boys or giving land for maybe in order that they might have a base to jump off or to train. And we can do a whole lot. And I think young people can do a lot if they've got the backup of the older ones. And if the older ones do not back them up, we're going to have to educate the older ones in order that they will go along with what the younger people will do. The reason we got our rights is because of young people, those high school students, those young college students. They were the ones who decided that we are going to keep on marching and demonstrating until our parents become registered voters. So, the young people can do a whole lot with the older ones. If the older ones are not awake, they are the ones to wake them up.
And you also said, kind of course I was a registered voter,
Why were you a registered voter when the others were not?
Only in 1920 could women become registered voters, and they would have to be 21 years of age. Now, when right after slavery in 1865, people men could run for office. No women. Women could not run for office. Women could not vote. And that's all women until 1920. But the men, the African American men, began to vote, and they held positions as congressmen, senators, police heads of police department. They were in all fields, all political fields. Then those, finally they got them out, because women could not vote and there weren't so many men throughout the South. Then in 1920, women were given the right to vote. And in 1933, I was 21 years of age. And when I became a registered voter, it was because I worked for the United States Department of Agriculture. And when I went up to register, they dared not turn me around because they feared that the federal government would come in and have something to say. That's the reason why. But I was not satisfied being a registered voter. I wanted to see all of these people, believe it or not, but the government had some rule known as the gag rule, that nothing pertaining to African Americans must come up on the floor. Consequently, from 1910 until 1965, there was not an African American that was in any position whatsoever, not even as a police or as a sheriff. No position whatsoever, because of the fact, number one, they registered very few of them, and only a few of them they thought they could use that they might register them. And I happened to be one of the few, because they feared was the reason why they let me register.
Didn't they also make up all kind of things that the people had, you know, outrageous requirements,
yes,
to keep them from being registered?
You have no idea. I mean, I bet within your mind you have no conception of how stupid it was to have hurdles that African Americans, this is white and all, this is blacks only, and they had black people, men, who had to work the road for 3 days to pay poll tax. They didn't ask them, could you pay poll tax? They just said, you get out there and work the road if you were 21 years of age. And yet, they could not vote. The poll tax was for the purpose of voting. Now, how would these people vote? Here's a hurdle they put up. You must have a home, property. You must not have any kind of mortgage on it. Nothing. It must be clear. You must have money in the bank. You must know the Constitution. Now you know how long the Constitution is. You must know the Constitution of the United States of America, and then you must have two white men, not women, and I think they realized women had hearts. Two white men to come in and vouch for you and say that you're a good Negro and you had property and money in the bank and so forth. They put up a whole lot of hurdles because they didn't want these people to register. So you see why we have to fight to get the right to vote.
And of course all of these things were only for the black, not for the
right.
whites.
Right.
I was wondering, it says here in the article from which newspaper? From when you were in Olmos?
Olmos Dixon.
That you went to the funeral of this sheriff who orchestrated the whole Bloody Sunday issue. And you talked about it earlier, how about it not serving any purpose to hate anybody, but I was just wondering how it has been possible for you, since he's done so many horrible things to you and to others as well, or at least as I said, orchestrated it, but how on earth it's possible not to have any kinds of negative feelings towards a person like that?
He refers to Jim Clark. Jim Clark was a man, and I have said it's very unfortunate because many of the other racists were like that. They were conceived in the womb of hate and rocked in the cradle of discrimination. I felt sorry for him. And there were many times the things that he did, I knew they were wrong. But I figured to know that it's wrong does not help the situation any. You've got to do something about it. And that is why we start working about 3 years after I got to Alabama to get people to learn how to fill out the applications, which at that time it was only a page and a half. And when they found out that we were fighting and helping these people, teaching them how to fill out the blanks, George Wallace sent on Mondays the applications. And the applications were 10 pages long. 10 questions on each page. That's 100 pages. And registration office was closed was open every second and fourth Tuesdays in the month. That's the only time you could register. And he would send them down on Monday night, which meant that even the registrar didn't know those questions. So we got attorneys and asked them would they interpret some of those questions. And they said, well, what you need is the attorney's dictionary. Now you know these people who were registrars didn't know anything about it. But even at that rate, the only thing to do was to march, demonstrate, and expose Jim Clark and the rest of them. The unfortunate thing about Jim Clark was he was a very ignorant man. And then, too, he was an evil man. With my office, being across from the city hall, and the city hall on one floor, the county, jail was on the fourth floor, and I could hear human beings that would be screaming and hollering, and they would beat them, they'd do anything, and the people couldn't vote, so there was nothing they could do about it, and they called that their way of life. Now the reason I went to the funeral of all of that, I said to myself, if you were to strip that man of his hate, he would be just like I am. If you could strip an African American of his, what do you call it, dermis or epidermis, which one is the outer layer of your skin, and of both people, we would be the same. So you can't hate. And when he died, I went to the funeral because I wanted his family to know that I had no animosity, no hate, no discrimination, that I had sympathy for even him and his spirit. And that is the reason I went. I got a chance to talk with his daughter. But the interesting thing about it is, and it's sad, when you live such an evil life, 2 years ago, 1 year, no, it's just a year, a little over a year ago, when we were celebrating going across the bridge, a white fellow came to me and said, I'd like to go down and see Jim Clark. I understand he's living, and I'd like to go down and see him. What do you think about it? And I said, I think it would be wonderful. So he went on down and talked with him, and when he came back, he said, you know, I talked with Jim Clark, and he said, if he were out, he was in a nursing home. If he were where he was last day, the time that he beat us up, he said, I would do the same thing today that I did back then 42 years ago. So he had not repented. Somewhat different from George Wallace. George Wallace was just as evil as Jim Clark was. But when Martin Luther King was shot, he said, yes, good for him. If he had stayed in his place in the pulpit, that would not have happened. But what did he do? He got out and started canvassing as a candidate for president of the United States. And he was shot. Martin Luther King didn't know anything about his shooting because of the fact he died immediately. But George Wallace lived 32 years in a wheelchair or in the bed, not being able to give himself a bath or take himself to the restroom or anything. 32 years. But before he died, he asked forgiveness. Now that's the difference. He asked forgiveness of God and the people for what he did. He said that was the political way, and he was in politics and he's sorry. But that's why I said, let go and let God take it, because he can do better than anybody else when it comes down to giving you a chance to repent for what you have done. But now when it comes down to Jim Clark, when I went there, we went to the funeral home. He was buried from the funeral home. I understand he was in a nursing home, and not a child
He had six children, many grandchildren, and some great grands. Nobody would come to see about him. And the funeral director tried to get a minister to preach the funeral. No minister would preach his funeral. And where, maybe you do the same thing, but whenever there's a funeral, you have a special place for the family to sit. Not one family, some of them came, but not one of them would sit in the seat as a family. So you know, I felt sorry for him. I felt sorry for him when he was in the nursing home because I thought perhaps he would have asked God's forgiveness. And I felt sorry for him because as he lived, so did he die.
Hey, Amelia, I'm part of the LaRouche Youth Movement in Berlin. And I was just in the United States and ran in a lot to people who were saying that, we don't want to talk to LaRouche, we don't want to talk to your fascist, basically listening to what came out of the American media. Now the situation is a little bit different because people are now losing their homes. And so you have people calling into the office saying, I've owned this house for 31 years, and I'm basically losing it now. And I'm looking at the Democratic Party, I'm looking at the Republican Party, and I can't find, well, basically any solutions from their side. So I'm ready to basically like drop everything that I've been doing in my past politically and work with you. And it's beginning a little bit to be the same characteristic in Berlin, my question is, when you have this kind of youth movement that we have, which is in a sense we're educating ourselves in understanding what LaRouche is talking about, the solution we've been talking about for a long time. But in this situation where things can begin to become pretty wild, where things can sort of tumble down around your ears, and you know that the politicians have been denying what's been going on for a long, long time, and what would your advice be to young people who might not have had so much experience and so forth? How would they deal with that situation? A second question. What is, when you speak about God, I think it's mystical to a lot of people, including myself also. So could you maybe elaborate on what is God?
That's a good question. Number one, that when you find somebody saying that we are fascists, ask that person, what is fascism? And though there is a reality, those who are saying it don't even know what it's about. Then you ask the question, what is God? You know, I've had so many people to ask me that question. God is two things. God is a spirit. And he that wishes him in spirit and in truth. Then God is love. That's all he is. Now, he doesn't have hands and feet and whatnot, but you can see the effects of God. The sun that rises. Who made the sun rise? The rain that falls upon the earth when it is needed. What man can do that? The beautiful earth, the beautiful ocean. Who made the ocean? But God is love. That's all. And you can see the effects of God. You can't see him. But if you see the wind that blows, And there's a piece of paper that you see that it moves that paper. Or you see the leaves on the tree and the bending of the boughs of the tree. You can see the effects. And that's what God gave to man when he blew the breath of life in man, and man became a living soul. You've got a conscience that tells you right. And you know, if you follow that conscience, that you would not make a mistake. Then, when a person dies, the spirit returns to God who gave it. You can call him God, you can call him whatever you want. But it's a supreme being that is higher than you or I. And you're guided by that conscience. We can say we don't believe in God, but you do believe in your conscience. You do believe there's something that guides you. And whatever guides you in the right direction, that's God speaking to you.
What do you say to older people who think that now it's time to retire and to let the other people do something?
That's kind of hard because I've never retired. and I'm sure you're talking about retiring from a position they've had for years. I say there's nothing that we can make right now. We have to do it through the years. That is why we have, and I'm sure you have, some form of social security or putting aside a certain amount of money for your older days when you're unable to work. So everything that is done is not done immediately. It's done through the years. But I say to those people who are retired, don't be retired. You may be retired, T-I-E-D. And you can do it by keeping the mentality active. If not, it will be just like our bodies. And I think most of us realize as we get old that we are not as active as we have been. And like me, they have to take exercise in order that we can get those bones where they would be manipulated. But if you are retired or getting ready to retire, my suggestion to you is to find Schiller Institute and be able to find out everything you want to hear about it. Where they came from, where they started, where they're going, what's going on, what is the purpose. And you'd be surprised to know how your mind will become activated, reactivated, and you will be able to live a long time.
I forgot to say it before at the introduction. I mean, Emilia, she was also in Odense, she was in Aarhus. Yesterday she was actually out of the gymnasium, Øregård Gymnasium out in Hellerup, and had a very exciting discussion with about 100 young people there, which were a much more lively bunch than tonight. That's why I'm saying it.
They think that first of all, if you wanna, like we have a certain rule, if you have to help people, need money. That's the first thing that we need in this kind of society. That's what people think. So, I mean, now it's pretty clear with the financial collapse. But still, some people think that they have to go through a lot of stuff to first be able to start in helping people. So first of all, it's coming something else. And the action of actually doing something to helping people. So how can you help these people to start doing something?
How can you happen to do what?
How can you help these people who think that first of all, before acting, they have to do a lot of other stuff to be able to act? So how can you help them to act immediately? What is their problem?
Well, you can't expect them to act until they know what they're acting on. We first will have to find people who are leaders among a group, a gang, just two or three of them, or whatever it might be. We have to find those folks. And then we have to tell them. They're not going out and talk about what we are doing unless they know it. Then we have to educate them. We have literature of all description, and just we have to let them know that within just a short length of time, you're going to have to take over. You're going to have to tell them something that they can look forward to. And if they know that, well, I don't like what's happening. I'd like to know, I don't know what you call it, but I would call it a commissioner. And that's one of the first jobs, political jobs, because that's your community, seeing that your community is kept in good fit. Oh, I would like to run for secretary. They have to be groomed, or it's just like if you have an idea, that idea can die unless we kindle it, like you put kindle a fire. You have to keep it alive, and you have to feed it, and you feed it by whatever you want to do. Be sure that you have information that will help you to understand what that specific thing is about. In other words, you have to be groomed in order that you can hold this position. And you find among the people who's the leader, even if there are two people together, find out which one seems to be the one that is more forward, or if there are four, or whoever it might be. Somebody is a leader. And you'll be surprised to know that people will follow that person. So that's my suggestion.
I would like to hear your advice on how to mobilize old people to keep them away from spending their money and losing their minds in the golf course and aimless travel. How do we go about that? Is there a need for a senior movement?
That's a good idea. Because people do spend a lot of money and time, but at the end of the day, what do they get? Mentally, what do they get? They are not able to say, well, I received information that will help me. So if you take, for instance, on the golf course, you've got a number of people who play. I don't know anything about golf except looking at it on TV. Now, if you get the group that you play with and say, let's have a guy to come in and tell us more about the thing you call Schiller Institute. Just let us get together. We don't know enough about it. Let us find out what it is. And call in one of them. You would be surprised to know, particularly these younger people. When I say younger, I mean younger than I am. And I'm 96 years old. So call in one of these younger persons and tell them that you have in this group. And you would like for them to come in and talk to you. And be sure to write down whatever specific questions you would like to ask them. And they will be able to give you all of the information to go above and beyond the call of duty, that when you leave there, you will leave there and find out that you are much more rewarded mentally than you were before.
Do you have a favorite ethical investment? Have you found an ethical investment?
Ethical?
Investment.
Ethical investment.
Like what?
Like spending 96 years in working on behalf of humanity now. Ethical investment.
For money. Where would you put your money?
Money? What money? people don't. Who has money anyway? Nobody but the rich and the wealthy do. No, I try to set aside at least enough for my cremation. That's all. And I want to be cremated because of the fact it costs too much to bury a person. And to put all that money in the ground and it doesn't do any good to anybody. I don't think I'd feel good even if I were in the casket. So I will be cremated. But I'll tell you what, I don't like in the United States of America the history that they have in middle school, particularly, about anybody. It is so trumped up, and there's so many lies about even the people they say that Columbus discovered America. But what I would like is, when I die, people like you who would like to give me flowers, to be able to have a specific place that you can give contributions. I would like for the contributions to go toward seeing that real history is implemented and published in a book. Real history. Not what the oligarchies want us to know about man, and about the countries and how the countries were founded, or who did this, that, and the other, who invented this, that, and the other. But I would like for it to be done in such a way that the books will be for the more tender minds, those who are in the fifth and sixth and seventh grade. Because I think of the things that were in my book back there in those years, and how it so indelibly imprinted upon my mind. And I found out after I got grown that it wasn't true. So I'm just hoping that real history will be in the reach of every young mind, something that will be true and something that will stay with them.
I'll just say as a comment to, because it is a question of investment. If you sit around with some money, what do you do with them in a world where banks are failing and stock markets is about to collapse and nothing seems to be safe? And there is only one safe bet, and that is to invest in making the world a better place. Then even if you get run over by a truck tomorrow, your investment will not be lost. I think Emilia shows a very good example of how that can be done. And it just happens to be by lucky coincidence that you are in a place where you can take whatever money you might have left over and can invest it in our campaign. And I can guarantee you that that's the best investment you can make with your money if you want to make history. Mm-hmm. And right now, as a matter, I mean, and as Emilia said, it's good to be in motion, but it's bad just to have a motion of ideas without having physical motion to carry through with. And it just happens that we have published a new campaign newspaper here in 60,000 copies that we want to get out as soon as possible to actually again discuss these bigger things. You'll see this both on the Kiedrich conference we just attended. There's also words of wisdom from LaRouche exactly on this whole financial crisis right now. We even have a program for what we need to do in Denmark to make a shift that can not only help Denmark but help the world. So we really need people to take bundles of newspapers and make sure they get out and make sure we activate people around us. And we need, as Emilia said, we need to have people come in also and really begin seriously to ponder and think about how do we do this. If, first of all, is it true that there's this financial crisis or it's just a phantom? You have to find out, you have to investigate it. If it's, when you then investigate it, you find out that it's 10 times worse than you thought. And then comes the next question, what do you do about it? So for that reason, we have already on next Thursday, we have a meeting in our office to discuss that. And on the Wednesday following, the 10th of October, we will have a special treat of a junior to Emilia, named Linda LaRouche, that I said was just 85 years old, just had his 85th year's birthday. But he will give a webcast from Washington that will be carried live on the internet on the 10th of October, but we will also watch it in our office. So that's also a very good place to find some good advice on what to do in these times. And finally, I also want to say, again on the question of money, this is free of charge and you should feel happy for that. But if you feel the need to actually also make an ethical investment here, then you can either take a membership as you go out to the Schiller Institute or simply give a contribution and help pay for the room and all of the activities there is. So,
and we did not pay this man to ask the question.
But I would ask you all to thank Emilia very much for taking the time and coming here and sharing with us. So please give Emilia. And on the back of this page, you presumably got with nice information on these two events. There's also the text of "We Shall Overcome." So, if you'll all join the youth, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. We to victory, we are on to victory, we are on to victory someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe. We are not afraid. We are not afraid. We are not afraid today. Oh, deep in my heart, I do not afraid today. The truth shall make us free. The truth shall make us free. The truth shall make us free someday. Oh, my heart, I do believe the truth shall make us free someday. We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace. We shall live in someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall live in peace
like they don't want to go, maybe quick.
Then they can come up and ask him.
Yeah.
They can come up and say.